There are a few common money mistakes most people are making, and it's keeping them from building real wealth.
Somebody is making bank off of you being in debt.
In today's episode, Mark Willis, a certified financial planner, a three-time number one best-selling author, and the owner of Lake Growth Financial Services, is here to debunk some common myths involving debt, investing, diversification, and more.
I left graduate school with six figures of student loan debt. My wife and I had no plan to pay it off.
He'll also explain the strategy that the Dave Ramseys of the world don't want you to know about.
Imagine having a life where you're not having to deal with what's going on in the headlines.
If you want to retire early, keep listening.
It's been a whirlwind tour for me over the last 11, 12 plus years. We live and work in the Chicagoland area, but we work with clients all over the country and really in parts around the world as well. We work with clients who are real estate investors, they're business owners, even some NFL Super Bowl champions, Gerwin. But you know, most of the people I work with are just wanting more security, confidence, assurance that they're going to reach their financial objectives without having to jump through a bunch of, you know, high risk trades or unnecessary risks of various kinds. So that's what we're all about here at Lake Growth Financial Services. I'm a certified financial planner and an author, and I love the work I do. It's a lot of fun.
That is awesome. A big theme I want to touch on today is debt and investing. In the past, in general, I think debt, there's a lot of misconceptions surrounding it. And in reality, I've heard you refer to it as something that, I think you read it in a book. I can't remember what book you read it in, but it said that if you have debt, it's someone else's asset. And so I wanted to start there. Can you expand on this point and explain what this means for the average person?
Sure. Yeah, there's a very powerful word in the English dictionary, maybe one of the most powerful, maybe the most powerful word. You'd have to really push me hard to come up with something harder or more powerful, and that is the word debt. Debt. That can be maybe the quintessential word of the human experience, actually, right down to the very core of our human beingness. In fact, there's a book called Debt, the First 5,000 Years by David Graeber, and the title itself, I think, explains quite a bit. Now, you think about the human history, the pain, the suffering that comes with that four-letter word, debt. And most of us spend our lives under the thumb of banks, banksters, credit card companies, finance companies, student loan companies, auto loan companies, mortgages, and we don't understand debt, and we just are abused by it. And on the same side of that ledger, you're exactly right, Kerwin. On the other side of every liability, it's someone else's asset. So somebody is making bank off of you being in debt to the bank. And that's the opportunity hidden in the tragedy there. For every person who's unfortunately taken their life or lost sleepless nights over that four-letter word debt, it can also be an incredible opportunity for you to take back control of your finances, to bring the banking function back into your personal life. And that's what we love working with clients on. One of the strategies, it's not all we do, but it's one of the strategies we feel has the biggest impact on someone's capacity to, you know, reach their goals.
Yeah, there's just this psychological side of debt too. I mean, even for myself, this is a candid moment, but like, even if I have like $25 on my credit card, it'll stress me out and make me so anxious. And I've heard stories. I watched The Big Short, I think it was, where there were reports of people committing suicide during the 2008 collapse. And so that you're so right. This is such a important topic. And I think it's like a double-edged sword.
It sure is. Yeah. There's a real belief that when you are in debt, you're in essence, a slave to the outcomes of the banker who has the puppet strings tied to your back. And, you know, I didn't necessarily see myself getting into debt when I was a kid, but I left graduate school with, you know, six figures of student loan debt. And we graduated in the midst of that great recession you mentioned. And my wife and I had no plan to pay it off. We were 120 grand in the hole and just starting out in life, and we had no jobs to knock out that debt. It was a scary time. But again, it's sort of like what doesn't kill you only makes you stronger. When you really begin to realize the it's almost like jujitsu in some ways. And again, I know we were talking about metaphors earlier, but this is, I think, an apropos one. I'm not really an MMA guy, but I know that in some martial arts, if you have your opponent attack you with a certain force and you know how to manage that force, you can actually leverage it into your own power and use that force against the opponent. You can take what's coming at you and actually turn a liability into an advantage for you or an asset for you. And that works, you know, on the fighting mat, but it can also work in your financial life as well. If you know how banking works, you don't have to use someone else's bank. You know, banking is a verb, but we think about it like it's a noun. You know, we think, oh wow, banks, they're the big buildings downtown, or they're that app on my phone. We don't think of banking like a verb, like I can insource my banking rather than outsource it and be the banker in my own life, sit behind the banker's desk and have that apparatus of control that I can now use. Now, as a certified financial planner, we've got all these tools on our dashboard, thinking about our clients' objectives and concerns from a holistic standpoint, tax strategy, estate planning, investments, insurance, all that gets baked into my conversations I have with clients. And I'll tell you, Kerwin, the strategies that make the most difference are not, can I swing 10% this year on my mutual funds? Besides, I don't know if we can ever do that, but you know, that's not where the juice is for most people's financial life. It's not, can I squeeze a little bit more rate of return out of these risky assets? The majority of the swing you can make, the smallest hinge on your door, financially speaking, can open the biggest door in your life is the banking function. If you have that under your control, then the rest of it is, you know, side order of fries.
So I want to dive into that for sure. But there's this experience I've heard you reference in the past where you, and I'll share my own example, but I was watching DC's Suicide Squad in the movie theater and I fell asleep and woke up and there's explosions happening. I had no idea what was going on. And you've used that experience to kind of parallel how a lot of people wake up to their finances and really have no idea where they are. And they wake up with like this bag of baggage and debt. Mm-hmm. So how did that for you, how did that experience reflect the way people wake up to their own finances?
Well, that's a thank you. And I can tell you've done your homework on some of my stories and analogies I've done before. And you're exactly right, Kerwin. Most people enter their financial life like we woke up in a movie, we fell asleep and we missed half the movie and we don't know why people are doing what they're doing. We look at the news headlines, we're like, why is the Treasury Secretary doing this with the FDIC? And why is that person raising interest rates? And why is the mortgage market going nuts? And why are sales of real estate, you know, doing what they're doing? And what, you know, why is the key question I hear a lot of people ask. And then they throw up their hands and say, well, the wizards behind the curtain are the ones that have all the answers. And I'm just destined to be a tennis ball floating down the gutter of life. And I just have to hold on and hope and pray that my 401k is enough for me to scratch out a living in retirement. And I'm here to say that's not a life I want to live. I don't want to just be a tennis ball floating down the economic gutter that other people's, you know, headlines are controlling my destiny. Why should anyone on Wall Street have something to say about what I'm going to do with my future? Where is that written? Where is it written that I have to put myself under their thumb? So yeah, you're right, man. I think part of this is really getting a sense of what is the money story we are in and what are the characters. It's like the old William Shakespeare quote, you know, we're all just, the world is a stage and we're all actors thereon, something like that.
Yeah.
What part do you have to play in your own life? What part does money play in your story with money? Is it a villain? Sometimes money is a villain. Is it a hero? You know, what is the part that you need to play right now? What's the next step you need to take? And really understanding all the parts to the play really helps you understand what you need to do next. If all you're doing is taking the advice from, God forbid, CNBC or the money shows or whatever, you'll end up with, as you said, a bag full of rocks. You know, I talk about this like, hey, you know, when you were a kid, you probably got a couple of student loans if you were like me. Then maybe you got a credit card or two because they were handing out free pizza. And then you get the Roth IRA because someone told you it was cool. And then you get the 401k to feel like an adult. Then you get the crypto to feel cool again. You know, and so it just sort of piles up. You get this bag of rocks on your back and you're just walking through life, and it starts to get heavier and you kind of get weighed down. So you pull open this bag and you're like, what is all this junk doing in here? It's not serving me. I can't tell what this stuff is. Why do I have this brokerage account from 20 years ago and it's got $75 in there? You know, why is it I'm doing what I'm doing with my money? And I think that's, and sorry to wrap this up a little long, Kerwin, but I think the key, the starting point to figuring out what's going on with money and for you to be the main character in your own financial life is to really stop and say, well, what do I want this money doing for me so that it's in my, I guess, in my world rather than being used upon me to, you know, make me act the way, you know, the leaders or the financial pundits want me to act. I want my money acting for me rather than it being acted upon me. Does that distinction make sense?
100%. And you describe it as this bag of rocks of the different sources of debt and liabilities people accumulate from early on in their adult life. And I've seen that. I think that's becoming more prevalent among people, especially post-college. They start getting into the rat race and also trying to keep up with their peers. And I wanted to know, because you did mention some examples of these rocks, right? Are these rocks, do they start as good opportunities and then they become debt and liabilities, or were they the wrong decision from the beginning?
Well, that's a really thoughtful question. I'm sure it's different for each person. You know, I think sometimes we grow out of certain assets, you know, the meme stock we bought, the AMC theater stock, maybe we grew out of that, you know, that's a positive way to spin that disaster if you unfortunately had that. But, you know, I think honestly, again, starting with the question, what is the function of my money today? What do I want it doing for me? Helps clarify a lot. You know, again, focusing on verbs rather than nouns really helps when it comes to money. If all we are hearing are the nouns, like you should get a brokerage account, you should get a 401k, you should invest in blah, 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 real estate. If all it is just nouns, we're going to be chasing somebody else's dream for our money, and that's never a good sign. But if we can focus in on what's the attributes, what's the personality, what's the characteristics of our money, then we can really get rid of a lot of old rocks and be able to forgive ourselves for that. It's not like we had a wrong thing. Most people, if they're saving and they've saved some in an old brokerage account or a Roth, at least you were saving. You know, that's great. Now, if you've got old credit cards that are piling up, maybe we should get rid of those too, because those are definitely liabilities. But starting with, hey, what do I want this money to doing for me? Things like, do I want it to be liquid and accessible? Well, that cuts out the 401k and the IRA and so many other things. Do I want it to be tax-free in retirement? That might cut out all traditional accounts and brokerage accounts and lots of other things. So if you just start with function, like, hey, I want it to have a good competitive rate of return, that cuts out savings accounts, you know? I want it to be, you know, private, so that if I ever got sued, God forbid, by, you know, tenants or whatever in my apartments, that I don't want to have them go find in all this stuff I have saved up for my future. So these are a list of attributes or characteristics that would really help you make some decisions on the noun after you've decided what you want your verbs in your money to be.
That question, what do you want your money to do for you? I know I would struggle with that. And I think we struggled with that when we first started investing and really just building our financial literacy. And I know that's one of the first questions you ask your clients when you bring someone on and start working with them. But like, I think you've also mentioned that people struggle with that in general. It's a hard question because it's not something that we're really taught to even think about. So what are some potential answers to that question that are maybe really common among the people you work with?
Well, let's play a little game. Let's do this back and forth if you want to. So what if I throw a few out, you throw a few out? Again, this can be blue sky thinking. I want folks to just imagine when I sit down and talk with folks in my conversations, it's fun to kind of just paint the sky blue with your ideas here. So I gave you a few earlier, you know, tax-free in retirement, liquid and accessible. These are characteristic ideas. How about passive income? You know, let's get this thing generating some income for me. What I want us to think about is if we could just create the perfect financial vehicle, just paint with any color we wish, what sort of things would it do for us, this mythical financial vehicle? So I gave you a few there, tax-free, private. What would you add to that list?
One of the main things for us, the main motivating factors, is lifestyle freedom and time freedom. And I think that's what passive income would achieve. So I would add those two.
Yeah, you want to be able to get that passive income.
Recession resilient.
Yeah, say, tell me more about that one.
Yeah, I mean, if there's an economic downturn, I would want to have confidence that like I will be able to rely on it and it will be stable during that time. Also, inflation resilient. So as we're seeing, inflation's higher than it's been recently. And I would want to make sure that the value of whatever asset I invested in is going to remain stable or rise as inflation rises.
Big time. Yeah, there is some big changes happening in our world today, and we can talk some about that. But you want to be able to take advantage of, and not just be protected by, you know, resilient, but I'd say I would even add to that a little bit and say not just be recession resilient, but anti-fragile. You know, I want it to get stronger under pressure, whatever this financial vehicle is. I want it to actually improve, like be more durable, not just durable, but even stronger. Like when I work my body out at the gym, I'm ripping that body down, but it's the aim to have it built back stronger. And that's the idea of anti-fragile. So yes, absolutely. We are entering into some very uncharted territory in our world right now. I want my money, whatever it is, to be resilient and maybe even stronger as a result.
Absolutely. And so to kind of build off of that exercise, what would be some financial products that you would say align with those goals?
You know, it's funny because so many people, I've done this thought exercise with many people, and you know, we've had similar answers come up, and it's almost opposite to where most Americans keep their cash. 401ks, IRAs, savings accounts, brokerage accounts, houses, you know, I mean personal residences. I mean, most of the time people's equity is in their house or in their 401k, and they got a little small savings account, something like that. And all they want is, as we've described, tax-free access to money, liquid money, protected, you know, recession resilient. Well, none of that is describing where most of our wealth is as a country. So a surprising right turn for me as a CFP was discovering, of all things, dividend-paying whole life insurance, designed a very particular way. We call it bank on yourself for short. It's a trademark term by Pamela Yellen. She did a ton of research on this, and she unfortunately got hooked up with the wrong insurance agents early on that thought they knew what they were doing to design these whole life policies the right way. She ended up saying, all right, I need to trademark this thing to protect the concept that was initially funded by Nelson Nash, who wrote these books years ago. But using a modernized form of whole life insurance allows our money to be doing essentially everything you and I just talked about. It, for example, grows on a guaranteed basis every single year. That's nice and resistant from recession. In fact, it improves as interest rates rise. We can talk some about that. In addition, the policy is liquid and accessible, meaning I can borrow and or withdraw from the cash value to use for any reason. There's no prohibited transactions like there is with 401ks and IRA money. I can borrow the money out, or I can withdraw the money out and fix up a rental property, or I can improve my own kitchen or send my kid to college. You know, there's no prohibition on what I use the money for. And it is life insurance, so I'm going to automatically leave an inheritance. That's something we didn't mention in our list, but a lot of people say they want to make sure they leave a legacy with this money, whatever it is that they want that money to do for them. And then finally, the last thing, I'll mention this briefly. I mentioned earlier that you can borrow against these policies. Well, the interesting thing is, and back to banking, you can act like this is a bank, in essence, for yourself. And you can borrow against the life insurance cash value. And much like a bank, the policy will continue to compound and grow for you as if you had not touched the money. So if you have $100,000 in cash value, and let's say you borrowed out $70,000 to do a fix and flip or something, well, your policy will continue to earn growth, guaranteed increases in the cash and dividends too on the entire $100,000, even though you'd access 70 to go fix up that house down the street. So in essence, this gives you the tools that a bank might use to get arbitrage, which is the fancy word of saying profits. And that's why I use my policies as the centerpiece for our financial future. And a lot of our clients do the same.
And we've had you on the past to talk about this topic. It's really fascinating. We've also had some other people come on and discuss whole life policies. And so it's no secret that whole life carries some controversy. And I wanted to touch on it because I'm just kind of fascinated by it, but also trying to get some hot button topics. Financial gurus like Dave Ramsey have been outspoken in their opposition to whole life insurance. And so I wanted you to kind of end it here. You know, what are some of those common downsides or the most common objections that you're hearing these people talk about? And is there a pattern in the warnings that opponents of whole life harp on?
It's so interesting to me that there's all this emotion around whole life insurance. Why isn't there the same emotion around mutual funds or index funds? I mean, is it interesting? It interests me anyway, that there's such a kerfuffle around whole life insurance when it's been around for 200 years. Okay, so the 401k is so young, it's only 41 years old. Now, does anyone know that? Does anyone notice that? That it's so young, it can't even retire yet? It's this grand experiment that we're all living in, and yet we all just think it's what God created on the seventh day or whatever. No, the 401k, mutual funds too, they're not that old. Index funds are even younger, and target date funds are some of the worst performing asset classes you can have, but everyone gets them as default in their 401ks. But yet Dave Ramsey and similar infotainers on the radio and on YouTube seem to think that Moses brought down mutual funds from on high. No, none of that is true. Whole life insurance beats and precedes all those assets by 100 plus years. Now, old fashioned whole life insurance has some troubles and some problems. I still like it for some purposes, but it's not great at building early cash value accumulation. So Dave Ramsey is right about whole life insurance. If we're talking about the kind your great-grandparents might have had 80 years ago, but he's just plain wrong about the kind of life insurance that you and I have been talking about for the last 20 minutes or so. So, and I can be precise if you'd like me to there, but I'll just say what we're talking about now is categorically different from the kind of whole life insurance you might have heard Susie Orman or Dave Ramsey talk about.
You said Pamela Yellen also kind of went with the wrong insurance providers. And to build off that, there are many different people out there offering whole life insurance policies. And I know they're not all created equal. What are some common red flags of a bad whole life policy or a bad provider?
Well, you're exactly right. And you're speaking to something that I unfortunately have the displeasure of finding all the time. People will hear me on a podcast like this and they'll reach out to me and they'll say, oh yeah, I've got one of those. Can you take a look at it for me? And so we'll look at their whole life bank on yourself, infinite banking, whatever you want to call it, policy. And they have an agent that set it up for them, but they haven't heard from the agent in a few years and they just want me to take another look at it. And so I do, I look at the numbers and it's a commission's nightmare. The cash is growing extra slow because of the unnecessary expenses baked into the thing. It won't grow when you borrow against it, which is something most people think will happen with their policy, but it's with the wrong company or it has the wrong writers, and it won't perform the way they've read about in the books or heard about on these podcasts or anything like that. They got the average Joe insurance agent to build this for them. Now, you're right, man. There are plenty of insurance agents. There's 400,000 life insurance agents in the United States. So that means there's like one agent for every 800 Americans. Now, if there were, I just want to ask you this, like if there were 400,000 heart surgeons and you needed, like desperately needed life-saving heart surgery, Kerwin, would you just go to the nearest guy or gal to get you that surgery, or would you look for the best one?
Best one.
Yeah. There are almost no certification or authorization programs around this strategy. And yet I met a guy just the other day, he had $800,000 across four policies in the wrong company. So this is a whole life contract. It had paid up addition riders. It was with a mutual company. I won't name the name, but when you borrowed against that policy, they charge you 8% interest, which is egregiously high according to the industry standards. And the growth would be reduced by any loans you took out. And this guy thought he had infinite family wealth banking, you know, Who cares? There's so many nicknames out there. The only one that has any kind of IP around it with training, ongoing certification, and continuing education that I have to do every year is Bank on Yourself. If you don't have a Bank on Yourself professional managing, setting up and managing this thing, it's sort of like getting into an elevator that hasn't been serviced by a technician, that certified technician. Now, I could fix your elevators in your apartments, Kerwin, if you need me to, all right? It won't be safe. You shouldn't get in them, but I can work on them for you. No problem. It's the same with life insurance policies. I know it sounds crazy, but there's 29 different characteristics that get into building these policies appropriately. And if any of them are not there, it's sort of like a pre-flight checklist on an airplane. You don't want to lift off until all 29 have been checked. And I've unfortunately seen people's tax disasters, again, riddled with commissions, growing too slowly with the wrong company, not paying out dividends. This all happens when folks rush in or work with the wrong agent.
I imagine a big holdback for a lot of people regarding whole life is the fees. And I know every single investment is going to have some kind of cost or, you have to invest. It's called investment for a reason. So this is a form of investing when you pay that fee. But I'm just curious, and I imagine it can vary depending on your financial situation, but is there like a rule of thumb for how much it is in terms of fees to start one of these policies?
Yeah, you're right. There's no getting around it. There are insurance costs. Even if we design this as much cash value as possible, there's still going to be an insurance expense because we're buying life insurance. And believe me, if we could just get rid of all the insurance expenses, we'd do that. But if we got rid of all the insurance expenses, all we have is a savings account at that point. You know, just get a savings account. But we know that the savings account won't do all the things that we want our money doing for us. So there, if we're using life insurance to do what we want our money to do for us, then there will be insurance expenses. So the cost is going to be somewhere around, somewhere between 65% and 85 to 90% of your money would be available to you in the first year. So I said that kind of funny. So I'll try that again. If you put in 10 grand, you're going to have somewhere between $6,500 and $9,000 available in the first year. And folks are like, well, where'd the other, couple thousand dollars go? It went to cover you if you should pass away this year, because there's like maybe a $250,000 death benefit that would be paid to your family this year in the first year. And you only gave 10 grand into the policy and you're getting back 200 plus grand. Yeah, that's an expense to the insurance company. So they hold back some of your cost or contributions or premiums to cover that potential liability to the insurance company. Now that's year one. I always tell folks, don't do this for a 1 year plan, 1 year proposition. We should be thinking about this as a long-term over time strategy. Somewhere around year four, we're still plugging away that 10 grand a year, let's say in this example. In year four, the growth of the policy might be 11 grand in cash value in year four alone. So this means from year one to year four, we are now done with the expenses of this policy and the growth is beyond what we can contribute to it. In other words, the net expenses are zero and we're actually being paid in essence to keep the policy in force. Now we're still overcoming the initial couple of years of expense, but the idea is slow and steady, ever increasing, liquid bucket of money that we can access for any reason. I don't call this an investment. I call it a life insurance policy with, some additional benefits, saving strategies and more. And it gives you that, I guess, ever increasing line of credit you can borrow against even when banks stop borrowing, which is what I'm seeing more and more of these days.
To me, this is such a timely topic. A lot of investors and economists out there are speculating that we're on the precipice of an economic downturn. And in a previous interview, you mentioned how whole life policies were seeing strong performance, and I'm probably butchering the quote, but it was something along the lines of during a market crash, they perform strong, or they were seeing strong performance. And I also think that applies to higher interest rates, which is what we're seeing right now. So my question is whole life best? Does it perform best during a market crash? And if so, why?
Again, I do think this is sort of the anti-fragile comment that's made popular by Nassim Taleb in his book, Anti-Fragile. So I recommend folks check that book out for more. But yes, as markets waver, whole life insurance looks stronger for two reasons. One, it grows on a guaranteed basis and pays out dividends on top of that guarantee. So that's incredibly cool when your neighbor just lost, like last year in the markets, average market loss was about 20% or so. But all of our clients with these policies protected every dollar in the policy and also hit an all-time record high in their policies. Right along the world, as the world was trying to figure out where to hide, they were getting all-time record highs in their policies. So that's the first piece. The second piece, to your point about interest rates, you're right. Bonds have been crashing and stocks at the same time. That's a very uncommon scenario for stocks and bonds to both be down, but they were last year, and it broke all the regular money rules. And again, as interest rates have risen, bond prices fall. But as your policy is continuing to grow, think about it. Insurance companies are investing the pool of money for the long term, and they're mostly investing in fixed income assets like bonds, mortgages, hotels, things that are basically paying out a fixed income payment back to the insurance company. So, and this is the cool part. So if this is kind of wonkish, you know, I promise I'm almost done. As the insurance company puts new monies to work in this higher interest rate world, which is happening now for the last year or two, they're getting higher yield on the bonds and the mortgages. So when you see a 7% interest mortgage and or higher, who knows how far this will go, most people cringe at that. I kind of cheer a little bit. I don't like it for all the pain that it causes the economy, but I know that my insurance companies that I have policies with are going to be gobbling up that 7%, paying it to me as a form of a dividend, which is in essence me being an owner in the company. If it's a mutually owned life insurance company, it's a part of the overall profits that the insurance company enjoys. And if they offer a dividend, which they're not guaranteed, dividends are not guaranteed, but if they offer a dividend, then that dividend goes up when we have higher interest rates. And oh, by the way, they've not missed a dividend in over 100 years. So I think the odds are pretty good they'll keep doing that, especially as dividends go up and interest rates go up.
And in face of this like looming recession that a lot of investors are preparing for, I know a lot of them, particularly we, also included in this, we're looking for ways to mitigate risk, right? I mean, it's all about risk mitigation. And many advocate for diversification. You've shared an interesting perspective in the past on diversification, where it's the common conception of diversification is put your eggs in 12 different baskets. But you've also said how that maybe isn't the best way to really spread your risk. And you've referred to this concept of non-correlated assets. So can you expand on like what a non-correlated asset is and how that connects to maybe real estate as an asset class?
Sure. And how much cooler this is when we combine the bank on yourself strategy with other assets like real estate too. So yes, your eggs might need to be in 12 baskets. And I get that. Get your, you know, your growth domestic, get your value, get your emerging markets, get all the different eggs in 12 different baskets. But what if all those baskets are on the same truck and the truck goes off the cliff? What good did that do us? What we want is some of our eggs in other trucks. And that's what you mentioned about non-correlated assets, meaning the money is simply not correlated when markets crash. So that's where whole life insurance comes in. It's simply impervious to market downturns. And that's a great relief for those that want the security of having something high, something going up in value when the rest of their portfolio is going down in value. That actually allows you to take more risk when you think about it in terms of the efficient portfolio theory. You know, if you're able to have a risk-free asset next to a risk asset, you can actually take more risk when you have a risk-free asset on this side of the barbell, so to speak. You can lift a little bit more risk that way. Now, lastly, remember how I said the policy continues to grow even when you access it for purchases? Well, a lot of people are sitting on their policies right now, and I certainly can't give any particular names or details, but let's just say a lot of our clients are sitting on a large portion of capital right now, waiting for that downturn that you mentioned so that they can be the cash buyer on the courthouse steps or whatever at discount prices. And remember, the real estate is now in their hands. They have no bank to worry about. and their policy is still continuing to compound and grow like they never took that loan out, thus giving them kind of two assets working instead of just one. Now, of course, there's always loans to pay back, and folks ask me about that. There is loan interest charged on policy loans, but again, the growth of the policy is typically greater than the interest charged due to the compounding on the entire policy value. So you don't want to just, you know, use this like a piggy bank and never pay off loans. I always tell folks to repay the loan so you can use the money again for the next downturn or the next car you need to buy or whatever else. So it's a way to kind of add nitro and glycerin together. You get the real estate, incredible advantages of real estate, along with the advantages of the bank on yourself design policy.
Yeah. And to clarify, in the context of real estate, a non-correlated or the correlated assets would be if you're investing in just multiple different types of real estate. Whereas if real estate as a sector takes a hit, then all of your investments are going to take a hit versus if you invest in something outside of that real estate realm. Is that right?
That's right. Yeah, you've got it.
Okay, awesome. Because so in the past, I've also heard you refer to this idea of the dispersion of energy, and you want to make sure that you're also kind of focused in your approach to investing. And I wanted you to maybe address that because I think that's important. You drew the image of a kid throwing a rock at a window versus throwing a bigger rock. Like the bigger the rock, the more impact you can have in your investments. And I don't think there's any contradiction there, or I'm sure that there isn't. But to me, that maybe conflicted with that notion of dispersing, of like also making sure that you're investing in non-correlated assets. So how should people balance that tension between making sure you are diversified enough so that you aren't really like, you know, have that overwhelming risk?
Yeah, diversification, that's another word I think we need to say. What is it we want our money doing for us? Is diversification really a function or not? And I would maybe say, no, what's the purpose of diversification? Well, Warren Buffett says it's insurance against ignorance. That's why he says he diversifies. So if you don't have any ignorance, there's no need to diversify. Well, most of us don't have a crystal ball, so we need to come up with some kind of contingency plan if our well-laid plans, you know, like mice and men, right? If the well-laid plans of mice and men can still go wrong, we need to think about, well, what happens if, ... What happens if the market crashes? So I do talk about the idea of focus. And that's, I think, what you're getting to, this idea of, let's say you got a bag of rocks that you've collected over your life. Let's say it weighs, I don't know, 5 pounds, 5 pounds of rock. And they're all little pebbles. And you decide to take them out of that little bag that you've created. And you've got this handful of rocks in your hand now weighing about 5 pounds. And let's say you see your way through a door. The only way to get through this locked door is to bust through the window. So you take that handful of rocks and you try to launch it at that door, and it's all little pebbles. So what's it going to do? It's going to hit the glass and just scatter. It's going to just essentially disperse because there's no focus of energy. It's scattered energy. And again, I see the conversations I have with clients. I see this dispersal of energy. We're throwing $300 a month in our 401k. We got $150 a month going into our brokerage account. We're trying to whittle away at our mortgage, throwing a couple extra payments on that every year. There's not very much focus. We spend half of our tax refund on flat screen TVs and whatever else. There's not much focus, but sitting down with a CFP, using this bank on yourself strategy as one of the tools in the toolbox. What if you had could replace your bag of pebbles with a 5 pound rock and you launch that rock at that glass door? What's going to happen to the door? Well, glass is going to shatter everywhere because focus. Now, again, is it a contradiction between that focus idea and diversification? I don't think so. And here's why. You tell me if I'm wrong. Ask my wife. I'm wrong often. So I'm okay with being wrong. But if you have an asset that can self-diversify, meaning I can borrow against my life insurance and go get some stocks if I really want to. I can borrow against my life insurance and go get some real estate if I really want to, or crypto. And if the crypto falls in value or the real estate falls in value, my policy is still growing. Sucks that I didn't get the great investment I was hoping for, but at least it's not a total loss. I still have the guaranteed increase of my policy. And over time, I'll have to come up with other means to pay off the policy loan. But at least I didn't have an absolute loss like I would have had I simply merely bought the real estate or the crypto with cash. So to me, it's like a source of capital for my other projects or investments that gives me the ability both to diversify and to consolidate and focus using the policy as my central hub. What do you think?
No, I think you did a great job of clarifying that, but also, yeah, I think there's no clear way to balance that tension. I think it's something you have to keep kind of like going back and forth. And I'm not going to lie, I didn't really know. I do think that investing in non-correlated assets was a new concept for me, and I really like that. And I do think that I've also heard Andrew Carnegie say, you want to watch, put all your eggs in one basket and watch it like a hawk at the beginning of your journey. So I think depending on how long you've been investing, that will also change as you mature and evolve. So where we are right now, we focus on real estate, but eventually our goal is to get into other types of assets as well. And so maybe my perspective is that it changes as you mature as an investor. What do you think?
Yeah, you know, I think it comes down to the personal decision, but I do think having a warehouse for your wealth where you can take action rather than trying to gobble up 12 different brokerage accounts to squeeze together one real estate deal. If you've got a pool of money, a contingency fund for all of life's needs that you can then use, you don't lose the optionality that you would have to lose if you had that money in four different apartment buildings or a 401k or anything else where it's not liquid. In a policy, it's still as open to all the options as it was before. It's, you know, I guess just having the money safe and liquid for any purpose take away any options? I guess not. It kind of leaves the options open so that we can diversify, like you said, out of real estate and into other asset classes and then back into the policy. Someday, you know, I hope to, and I continuously invest in different syndications and whatever else, but it always comes back to my policy. It's kind of like, and I'll stop with this analogy, I hope, but it's like my car. My car lives in my garage, but it always has the option to go anywhere it wants to go if I drive it to the business investment opportunity, or if I drive it to my office, or I can drive it to my, you know, to my kids' events, or taking my wife out to eat. But it always comes back to my garage where it lives. It doesn't stay there, but it lives there in between my opportunities. I feel like that's the same with your policy. It's sort of like a garage for your money. It shouldn't live there, shouldn't sit and sour in there. You should be getting that money and putting it to work in smart ways.
Yeah, I think at the end of the day, this is all in service of what we were touching on earlier, which is to help people reach those financial goals once they identify what those are. And I know a common one for most people, maybe not even intentionally, but it's to work towards their ideal retirement life, or whether that's early retirement or having the freedom to travel once they want to retire in their later age of life. In the past, you're like the king of analogies. So I wanted to have you use the one where you're climbing a mountain, and retirement is often, you kind of use that to reflect that, and people maybe plant that flag in the wrong spot and maybe just kind of approach retirement from the wrong angle. Can you expand on how retirement connects to that idea of climbing a mountain and where people falsely plant that flag?
Well, you're the king of really listening well to all these then. Thank you for the kind words. Yeah, I really think that you need to kind of go up and down the ladder in your conversations with clients. You need to be ready to get into the math and spreadsheets. And I'm happy to do that with folks. And I do that every meeting when I go through strategies and proposals and ideas. But you need to also apply it to things that people actually can tell or feel or sense or see. So yes, you're right. When it comes to retirement, I think most retirement planning has failed us because they're aiming toward the wrong goal. Now, my wife and I, we met in Texas, but we fell in love in Japan. And one of the big projects in Japan was to climb Mount Fuji. So we did. We climbed Mount Fuji. And I gotta say it, man. I think that was the most incredible workout I've ever had. It was an incredible experience. So hard climbing up the mountain. And you get all these little stamps on your cool little stick they give you as you climb higher and higher. But then you come down and you think that's going to be easier. No. Apparently, according to National Geographic, 85% of deaths are coming down Mount Everest. Coming down the mountain is harder than going up. And there's a lot of reasons. I'm not a doctor, so I can't get into all the reasons. But let's just say I felt like I was going to die like half a dozen times going down that mountain. And I feel like most people's retirement it's literally called assets under management. So you're just climbing up this mountain and getting fees for, you know, handing your money over to an investment advisor. And then you reach the summit and then they're like, sayonara, you know, see you later. Hope you had a, you know, good time climbing the mountain. Thank you for your fees. And now they're looking for the next 35-year-old who's opening up his 401ks and IRAs to collect that fee off that guy or gal, you know? And I'm speaking a little bold here. I know that there's some really good financial planners, but there is no real training, even at the CFP level, for dispersing or distributing what you've accumulated. It's sort of like, well, we don't know. You got your $2 million in your 401k. That's great. But how much should I spend? What's the right amount of money to take out of that 401k so I won't outlive my money? That's the $2 million question for that person. And there are strategies we don't have time to talk about them today, but love to come back someday if you ever want, that have nothing to do with bank on yourself, that have everything to do with making sure you get down that mountain, not only to get all the way down the mountain. I think the flag should not be planted at the summit. I think the flag should be planted way back down at base camp after you've summited. And really, maybe you should hand your flag to your next generation. Give them the provisions they need. You know, why stop with you? You know, give some to the next generation so that they can successfully climb their mountain and let that process continue. Imagine having a life where you're not having to deal with what's going on in the headlines or what the market did yesterday or is going to do tomorrow. I can help with that. Myself and my colleagues work, you know, day in, day out, do this full time. We love doing what we do. And you can reach out to me and speak with me for a 15-minute phone strategy session to see if any of these strategies would make sense for you at kickstartwithmark.com. That's kickstartwithmark.com. We'll have a quick 15-minute phone strategy session, see if any of these strategies make sense for you.